That was a slow version of a good oldie. And it's slow because, that's pretty much the fastest I can go for myself at this point if I were to consider dancing to this music. I can't move faster than that. So I figured I will share the good news with you. I have considered the possibility that many of you, like me, we can't go faster than that. That's Lou Donaldson on organ with the Isley Brothers classic, It's Your Thing. It's from his 1961 album, Hot Dog. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it's Free Your Mind Friday. This is the day that you get to take the conversation wherever you wish to take it. But let's have a conversation. Don't just talk and drop some knowledge and take off. Engage in conversation so that people can join us after hearing what you have to say and either challenge you or accept what you're saying and move on to another direction. But the idea is this is a time that I set aside specifically for the exchange of information, opinions, and ideas, and this is your time. Technically, we should be doing another follow-up. We'll do that next week. There's a lot of stuff developing, and it is going to be explosive. But in the meantime, that doesn't mean you get routed out of your time. This is Friday, and it stands, right? Except if we have something exceedingly important to talk about. And then, with your permission, we use the time and make up for it at another time. But I really feel strongly that one of the missions of the program, and I try in every program, but sometimes it's impossible to cover the full breadth of what it is I want to talk about and still accommodate calls. But definitely on Friday, this is the listener's time to bring attention to things that we should be considering. At 888-874-4888. And again, we're looking to engage each other in conversation and engage each other in the exchange of information. From Montreal, Randolph, you're on the air.
Hello, Eutrice.
Hello.
Hi. I'm calling today because I heard a president of one of the EU countries make a statement that government policy is not made on the streets of the nation. My question is, why not? After all, the political campaigns and meet the electorates takes place on the street. After all, the streets are to the human well-being as blood vessels are to the human body. People take to the streets because the people who generally run the corporations of the world's personalities conflict. Their objectives conflict sometimes with the well-being of the people whose blood, sweat, and tears are making the corporation well-being profitable. So, what is your point of view?
Well, first, if you can tell me, is he referring to the movement in Spain when he said that, the Catalan movement for independence?
Well, also, I was thinking of France, but I didn't think of Spain. You're right. You're right.
Okay. Well, I think we could appreciate that he's coming from the point of view of a manager of society, let's say. And it is not a good thing from his point of view to have people taking to the streets. They equate that, of course, with rebellion and revolution, which is what the Catalanian movement is. It is about getting outside of that arrangement that they've been in for so long that curtails their liberties as they see it. So people, it's a law and order position, and I don't know that it is necessarily a correct one, but that's his vantage point.
Okay.
I think in other areas, however, you can see the necessity, because that is a typical position that all governments will take. They don't like people in the streets. It's embarrassing. And especially from the point of view of who holds the power, who causes change. It is the position, the natural position of almost all governments is we're in charge. You can't tell us what to do. We tell you what to do.
And,
so this is probably the position that he's coming from.
Right. But the fact is that the entire well-being of the economy depends on people being on the streets, the entire economy, or pretty well most of it.
Reporting for duty, in other words.
Well,
most often when people are in the street, they're behaving very well.
They're
going to their jobs to pay their taxes, and they're not in a state of rebellion, and they're not confronting government. But in the sense that you are pointing it out, people in the street equals rebellion. And this
that's not true. That's not true.
But when you say people in the streets, then, what do you mean?
I mean people shop on the streets, people's commerce takes place on the street, and non-violent protests. The people go to the streets when they see no other alternative. It's a form of communication. I mean, they can't all go to Parliament. They wouldn't be allowed.
For anybody in government, all these reasons that you first iterated as to why people are in the street going to their jobs and doing shopping and so forth, these things are not acts of rebellion, so nobody would be concerned about that. When they become concerned is when people turn to the streets to confront government, to compel the government to behave differently, and to basically they're disrupting, from the eyes of those in power, they're disrupting that natural order. So when people take to the streets, it is to be assumed automatically that this is a confrontation.
That is sad, isn't it? They really
yes, it is.
Communicating. It's a form of communication, just as you send an email, just as you send speaking. It's a form of presence, and the presence.
Yes, but look at the other form of communicating on the other side. One side communicates by trying to get people's attention about the seriousness of a situation that affects a whole bunch of people. The other side responds with tanks and more law enforcement presence and threats to take people into custody and to, beat them up and take away their rights. So it's also communication, but the issue at hand is who has the power. In the Catalan situation, as you know, one side is looking to break free from Spain and to establish their own entity, their own independence. This is not going to be tolerated by Spain. Spain says, we own you. You don't get to sever ties. We decide whether we should allow you to declare independence.
But it's independence of thought. It doesn't necessarily mean breaking up. It's independence going to move anywhere. Catalonia can't move anywhere. They'll still be part of the European Union.
So yes, it's the same arrangement, for example, that the United States has with Puerto Rico. How many times has Puerto Rico sought independence? How many times has the United States said, no, it's not going to happen. Forget it.
Dear Uterus, do you know any country on Earth that is truly independent? We all are all interdependent. No one is independent, truly.
Well, on a philosophical plane, I appreciate your argument, but it does not apply in the practical world.
Yeah.
Because independence equals loss of power. Independence equals loss of revenue. Yeah. Independence equals perhaps an increased exposure to other forces trying to contest their power too. So it's more than just being philosophical, it's the practical matter of how throughout history we see the desires of a people or population, and we see the countermeasures of the power authority that is in a position to either decide to let them have their wish, but most often they decide, no, you're not independent. You're not going to be independent. Thanks for getting us started today.
Thank you very much.
I really appreciate your call. Thank you so much. Jose from Rosedale, you're on the air.
Greetings, my professor.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Not bad, not bad. And as always, I wish you great health forever.
Thank you.
Now, I don't know if the elder is allowed to go off in a different direction.
You, it's your day. You can go wherever you wish.
Okay, thank you. Now, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I was listening to a radio program, and this pastor was on. And he talked about the evils of war and that there are no winners in war and it is everyone is a loser and he went on and on and on and on. And so he opened up the phone line and I just couldn't help myself and I called him and I said, Pastor, I beg to disagree with your analysis of wars. And he said, well, why is that so? So I said to him, well, as far as I can remember, all these wars that have come down through the ages, there were always winners and losers. I said to him that the geography of people's land has constantly changed by the powerful beating up on the powerless, taking over their land, their resources, and enslaving them. And doing things to them like they're doing in Puerto Rico, and what have been done to us in the Caribbean and Africa and all these places. And I pointed to him how after these wars, that the powerful never goes out there and physically get on the battlefield and fight. They are the one that direct the behavior of these poor young men and women that goes out there to give their lives, claim that they're fighting for a democracy that they don't have in their country, that they never enjoyed in their country. And they are the ones who sit back and enjoy the spoils of these wars. They have this military machine where the arms manufacturers make trillions of dollars off the manufacture of these weapons of mass destruction and all the ancillary services that goes with maintaining wars and capturing people's land and holding on to people's land and so on and so forth. So I said, don't take my word for it. Study history, and you will see that what you're saying is not correct. And so we had the back and forth until eventually he said, well, you're entitled to your opinion and you have to, and I respect your opinion. And we went on and that took care of that. But I want to come forward now to what has happened with this young man, this Green Beret brother that went on the continent of his ancestors, his ancestral homeland, to carry out imperialist ambitions on our continent, our homeland. And this young man was there fighting on behalf of an imperialist government. And he lost his life on his ancestral homeland. And now it has become a controversy where this man that is supposed to be president of the United States as dishonoring this young brother and get into a hissy fit with this congresswoman who has spoken the truth. I believe every single word she has said. And then his lackey, Kelly, has to step in with, I could see the lies just dripping from the, you know, my professor, I'm of the opinion a long, long time ago that most white folks don't have any shame. They have no shame because of the things that they do to other people and have the nerve to try to defend it. And yesterday I was looking at the news where this young man lost his life also, I think, in Iraq. And the father said he has never received, the family never received a call from this president. Right? And when the reporter was questioning him, he said something to the reporter, which most the bereaved family of these fallen soldiers has never said, not to my, as far as I can remember. He said that the young man, right, he was he was saying something here against what this man was saying, that these young men, they come out of school. They have no jobs. They have nothing going for them. And they say, well, the military is an alternative. And they get into the military, I guess, with the hope of surviving and to come back and maybe do something with their life. And that is why many of the young men go into the military. And they go in there and many of them go and kill people, innocent people in their land, right, to support this imperialist government. And they come, and those who survive and come back to this country of this great democratic hypocrisy, they never enjoy the sweets that the boys and girls who send them off to wars to go and to conquer other people's land. And so okay, I want to
bring you to a point here.
Yes, my queen. Yes.
What is the point you're making? I understand everything you've just said.
Okay.
What is
your point? The point I'm making is that they're making a whole lot of hullabaloo about these young men going off to become heroes and fight for the country and so forth. And I beg to differ with that. I don't see where these young men who goes off and shed their blood in the name of imperialism, where they are heroes. I sympathize with the young men. They go off on many of them. It's an economic draft. They go on the fight because it's a job and so on and so forth. But I don't see where this whole patriotism thing, that's not it. Because these wars that they're sending these young men off to, it's not anything about them fighting to defend this country. Nobody has invaded this country or come here to capture this country and colonize or anything. They are
but
the ones that in
but
other
you have
people's
to understand.
Land.
You have yes. to understand. Well, I don't mean to say you have to understand. You mm-hmm. should appreciate the fact
mm-hmm.
that in the middle of all of this, you are mm-hmm. arguing on a whole different plane that I would suggest does not apply.
No?
No, it doesn't. Because you are assuming that there is some kind of reciprocation here between a government and anybody who is sent to war. There isn't. We just finished in the first conversation we had. The government is its own entity. It has its objectives. It plugs people into those systems that they want to maintain and the things that they have to execute in order to maintain dominance. That's all that government is.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it does. It needs people to do that. The cannon fodder is the word that comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care where they come from. But we know that they're very careful, because it's also a class situation, that most people who go into the military are not from the upper classes.
Never was.
Okay. So what I'm saying is, put your argument in context, and you will see where the argument is and where it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
When we become very emotional, and we should, because that's a reflection of the fact that we're human.
Yes.
The other side, as you notice, is not very agitated. It expects people's children to die.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they're not going to be emotional about it. Here is a four-star general describing, in effect, how a body is treated once it's dragged off of a battlefield and you pack it in ice and you send it home. Okay. But that's not the argument, is it?
No.
From his perspective, because he is an administrator of this process, it's a cold, calculated thing. He dies, this young man dies, well, we just find another one, plug him in. We, on the other hand, we are emotionally involved because we are reacting like human beings. We see the callousness and the uselessness of it. Here's a young man in the prime of his life. His wife is expecting a baby. He already has one. And he's starting out in life. The assumption is, on our part, that he's entitled to life itself. That's not a calculation by the military. Before a battle even starts, they know how many people are likely to die.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They have their resources available. They have that sector of the military dealing with shipping dead bodies back home.
Yeah.
Okay, that's how they look at it. Do we have enough caskets? Do we have enough ice? Do we have enough planes to transport these bodies home? And once that is done, they put a flag on the casket and they play the national anthem when the bodies arrive at Dover Air Force Base, and they're done. Next. And it won't be their sons, it won't be their daughters being shipped to replace the dead one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's their mentality. We're getting very upset because we are actually expecting this system to have a soul, to be human and to be humane. It wasn't designed for that. And by the way, I agree with you. The congresswoman is quite believable, and both Trump and the general are equally dispassionate about it, and they're wrong in the way they responded. But we are coming from two different places. You're coming and I'm coming from the point of view of a lineage in war and the expectation that the people who put their lives on the line, at the very minimum, should be regarded differently, should be treated differently, especially when they lose their lives. That's not the system. The war system doesn't deal with these issues that way.
Mm-hmm.
This is just cannon fodder. You get shot down, well, if we have time to go get you and put you in a casket, send you back home, we'll do that. But the first thing and the most important thing, my father used to tell me, the most important word is next.
Mm-hmm.
They yell next. and that's it. We have to understand how systems work and the mentality of systems. We actually expect an inhumane system, a system designed to produce death on a massive scale, to have a soul. You can't have both. You cannot have both. And when you have a system that is about killing people, taking what they have, including life itself, that's a whole different mentality.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with what you think of as logic and kindness and human interaction. It doesn't exist. Not with these people, not with that system.
In closing, I would like to say to you, right? I, as an elder, have not lived on this planet for this length of time. I not understand the evil and brutality of the system that controls the world. But sometimes you get a bit emotional. It's not that I don't understand what these people are all about, right?
I commiserate with you. I have the same feelings about it because I just thought it was such a waste,
yes.
A waste, and such a disgrace. But
yes.
Again, if we were to take a long view of this, we would see that they're not behaving any differently than from the days of the Civil War. I mean, they think that people are expendable. It's a matter of how far could you get with respect to a plan, a premeditated plan, with the resources you have. And they consider soldiers resources.
Mm-hmm.
We have to reconstruct in our heads, and we have to redesign how we regard these systems. But we have to understand them.
Mm-hmm.
So that in understanding them, perhaps this young man may never have even gone.
Yes.
See? So we have to recalibrate all the time. But I wish the family can cope well enough that they don't lose their minds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they can still stand strong.
Yes.
Thanks so much. Thank you for your call today.
As always, Harvey, ancestral blessing be upon you.
Thank you so much for that. Harvey from Berkeley, how are you doing?
Pretty good. Wonderful, Eutrice. And bless you and your vast Progressive Radio Network audience.
Thank you.
And
same to you.
My pleasure. And since there are so many people being wounded and killed by gun violence, I have an idea that I might have mentioned before to help reduce this easy access to guns. And the media is constantly telling us that there are two major things that injure and kill a lot of innocent people, and they're cars and guns. But the difference between them is that cars are insured and guns are not. And imagine if the American taxpayer had to pay for a majority of car accidents. And it turns out that guns are the third leading cause of injury-related deaths in the United States. The gun industry is the poster child for privatizing the profits and socializing the losses. And over 700,000 people were treated for gunshot wounds between 2006 and 2014 at the cost of around $22 billion. Unfortunately, a substantial amount of the costs were picked up by us taxpayers. And why should the American taxpayer pick up the tab for all this needless carnage when our tax dollars would be better spent on social services and programs, education, infrastructure repair, and, of course, a single-payer health care system? And no one knows more about death and destruction than the insurance industry. It's their bread and butter. And because insurance companies are a for-profit industry, they'll make sure that people who own guns are fully registered, screened, and held responsible for their actions. So it's time to stop this assault on us and our tax dollars, and gun insurance would be a good first step in bringing this murder situation under control. So I was wondering, Eutrice, what are your thoughts on this issue, and what do you think of the concept of gun insurance?
Well, I did a program last week, at the beginning of the week, about the symbology of the gun and it hasn't changed. We really are not talking about guns. If it's not guns, they'll say rocks. We use rocks instead to kill each other. If it's not rocks, they'll say, well, we'll use baseball bats. The gun, we have to understand the gun and what it means in the total transformation of societies based on those in power and those who are not in power. The gun is, I think, permanently attached to the psyche of the United States, which is one of annihilation, one of destruction, one of domination. I even mentioned in that commentary, those lovely pilgrims, those prayerful pilgrims, arrived with their guns. They didn't come to the United States to meet their brothers and sisters and to enjoy a kind of interdependent life in which they come with no intention of causing harm or death to anyone. No, they came with that intention. And the spiritual nature that we expect people of that type to have, you know, the Ten Commandments obeying type of people, they have their insurance. The insurance was the gun. The gun was the principal method of carnage all over the world. That's what I talked about. The Caribbean, Europe, the United States, this hemisphere, the entire hemisphere, totally affected by gun ownership, mass genocides, guns. It's not about the capacity of human beings to think and to reason and to talk things through. They don't have time for that. The guns were used to depopulate species that historically have sustained life to the indigenous peoples wherever they were. You use a gun. And then you make bigger guns to inflict even more damage and more death. But the gun and the symbology of the gun is what we have to understand. It's not the gun itself. The intention behind it, to dominate people, to obliterate them, to take what they have, to rule the world. The gun is the means by which you implement your mentality. And that's why we can't stop this thing, because it's deeply rooted in our culture. I read a story a couple of weeks ago that four men basically, you know, they boozed up. This is in the Amazon jungles, a remote area. They went to a bar, had some drinks, and traveled for 10 days. 10 days by boat. And they went upriver, and they found this group that are described by anthropologists as no contact. They have had no history of contact with anybody. But these guys heard that there may be precious metals there. And they obliterated practically the whole village. Just four guys. With an intent to kill, in order to steal what was important to them to make money from. You cannot explain a mentality like that. But with the advantage of the gun over the power to kill, they were able to inflict greater pain and death because they had guns. And they killed off practically a whole village to do it. And purposely set out, 10 days you're going to ride up river. So the gun question is only an extension of the initial question of domination and the capacity of human beings to be really brutal in pursuit of domination. Like I said, if it's not guns, if they agreed that they'll use baseball bats, then it's a weapon. Whatever weapon helps them achieve that, they will use it. We are a gun society. You go to the movies, everybody's shooting. And nobody gets excited because it's expected. You see a Western movie, it's all about guns. A war movie, obviously, is all about guns. So in our society, the gun is an inseparable part of our culture and our so-called values. And it's not really the gun. The gun is an agency of power. We transmit our desire to dominate other people, to kill off other people, to do evil in the world. The gun is our weapon. Look at the guy out in Las Vegas. One man. Look at how much damage he caused with guns. So we have a love affair with guns, and we have to understand, why is it that we so admire and love and want to have guns? There's something there. Thanks so much for calling, Harvey. Great always to hear from you.
Thank you, Jeez.
Thanks a lot. Gwen from New York, you've been hanging on there for a while.
Good night. It's Free Your Mind Friday. Of course I have to hang on. But God, I'm so depressed now. I think I'm going to kill myself. Okay.
What are you freeing your mind of today?
Well, I want to say something about this Harvey Weinstein thing. And what I want to say, first of all, is everybody needs to look behind every event, I think, that happens in this country. But with this particular event, I had something happen to me a couple weeks before this. And, you know, I was a victim of rape when I was 16. It was my introduction to the world of intimacy. And my story is exactly the same as those women who spoke about it. And the thing is, I went to a writing workshop a couple weeks ago at the Veterans Center because my husband was in the military. I had been invited to go to things through the VA, and one of them was a writing program. And so I sat down at a table with a bunch of people. We were all women. And the topic to write on was write about when something you thought turned out to be something different. And I have never written this story before, and in fact, I never even spoke about it. I don't think I spoke about it for 13 years till after it happened, and it was pretty. It wasn't intended, you know. I didn't intend to speak about it. I just thought that it was entirely my fault, and I kept silent. But you know, things have a way of making their way out in other ways. You know, anger and. Just other things. But the point of the story that I want to tell you is that while I was sitting with these women were actually in the Army, and the four women that I was writing with were also African-American, and they were also from all over the country. We were all from all different places. And so the assignment was to then read back the story you'd written. So I was the last one to read my story, and they started reading theirs. And every woman at the table, including myself, had all been raped or sexually accosted before the age of 20. And so my reason for writing this story was I thought it would be cathartic, and I thought once I wrote it down, I would feel better. It would be out of my system, and it would be, you know, sometimes they say if you write it, you release it. But that didn't happen for me, because when I found out about the other four women, I got even more angry, and I didn't even finish reading my story, and I felt terrible. And I said to the teacher at the end, I said, you know, what's really fascinating about this class is not the writing, is the incidents that have happened to we women. And so I went out into the world, you know, and wasn't too happy for a couple weeks. And then all of a sudden, the Harvey Weinstein case burst open. And in a way, I think that women need to thank Harvey Weinstein for having his story be told. And the reason is because it's released a lot of women from that feeling of shame and not being able to talk about what actually happened to them. And so it's not hundreds, it's thousands, maybe millions of women are going to talk about this. And I don't think we would be having a conversation or acknowledging it or anything if the person who had done all these deeds had not had such notoriety, fame, and money. And so in a way, he was the fall guy that got the conversation going, that I hope it doesn't stop, because I think the silence of women amongst other women is one of the worst parts of the whole aspect of being accosted sexually, is that we don't tell each other, we don't talk to each other, and we just try to get on with our life. And something always happens to people that have been victimized. Some, it comes out in other ways, or you try to fix it the best you can, but, you know, unless you're in therapy, and sometimes even with therapy, you don't know how to make your way through. So, in a way, Weinstein, in my opinion, did the women of America a favor because we are now having this conversation. And I think that he will go to jail, and I think he should go to jail, because I think that there are a lot of people that have done much, much less than he has that are sitting in jail. Now, I also want to talk about this and just say that the timing of this case, though, is very interesting to me, because we were talking about Puerto Rico, and then all of a sudden, everything goes over to the Weinstein case. So we're really not talking about Puerto Rico. And Puerto Rico still has 1 million people that do not have drinking water. And they are drinking out of Superfund sites and taking baths in the creek. And we're not talking about this. And there are so many weird things that are happening in America that one of the things that I think we need to do is every time we see one of these gigantic events happening, is that we need to ask ourselves, what else is going on at the same time? Because these events like the Weinstein thing have diverted a lot of attention over there. First, it was the shooting in Las Vegas. Then it was the Weinstein thing. And so poor Puerto Rico is still lagging along, right? Now it's 4 weeks with still no drinking water for 1 million people. It's a lot of people that are not getting water. And we don't know how many people have died. And I guess as I go through this, and I'm so frustrated because I'm a pretty proactive person, is that I said to my friend today, I said, I think that we are all victims of wanting to be, you know, wanting the government to handle it. Well, yes, this is a job that the government should be handling because it's so big and the government owes it to this country. But, you know, if the government is not going to help them, then I don't see why we on the mainland can't do something. And, I mean, there's lots more of us hanging around in this world than there are government officials or government agencies. And it might seem naive, but I think that, you know, we don't live in a place where this government's going to be taking care of you. We live in a place where this government might be trying to harm you. And so we need to, as you say, have a new system of thinking. And that is when the government doesn't step up to the plate to do what they need to do, that we have to step up to the plate. We're just sitting on the sidelines watching as this country falls all the way off the cliff.
But here's
you know what happens.
Here's a problem.
But you could, because you know
you
what
have
happens.
Highlighted, you've highlighted stories that are massive in terms of impact. Here's the thing that I don't like about the United States, and I certainly don't like it in the U.S. media. Let's take one by one. The Weinstein case, this is a case of the head of a company called Miramax, which played a major role and is a major force in Hollywood.
Democratic Party.
And as donors to the Democratic Party, particularly. And it was found, or it has been disclosed, and it's still being disclosed, that the head, the guy who was really hands-on in creating these movies and being at the center of this money-making venture was a freak. He did many sexual things to women, allegedly. Now, hear me out because it's going to be controversial. This is being treated as a story, and it should. I mean, it has impact and so forth. But we do not, whether as a survivor of his torture and whatever it is, or people learning about this story, we don't have the capacity to deal with it. And it is being treated as a story. And I have a problem with many of the women who have come forward. Number one, immediately they have cut men out of the picture as if men don't get sexually assaulted. It's about women and our need to be made whole. No, we don't have the capacity. We don't have a system to deal with this sensibly. And the more that the media basically covers this story in this way, the farther away from center we are, because this is an issue that affects everybody. Yes, the people who have come forward have come forward mostly they're women, but I am sure if we intend to understand this problem, we will understand also that little boys are affected, grown men are affected by this problem. So we cannot afford this advertising campaign that is going on now to make it appear that it's men doing awful things to women. It's people doing awful things to people. And we haven't seen yet the capacity, even as the story develops, that there's a consciousness that it ought to be handled differently, because the consequences could be far-reaching. Because you're setting up now, even in the beginning stages, you're setting up a dichotomy of sexual acts against women versus sexual acts against men versus sexual acts against children as separate things. And each constituency, as we see things develop in other areas, they will now develop a constituency. It's the same thing that happened to cancer. Cancer is cancer. But because there's so much money behind it in terms of fundraising, we are led to believe that cancer of the breast is one thing and cancer of the liver is something else. It's cancer, folks. It's just cancer. One isn't more lethal than the other or more important than the other. One is perhaps more well-funded than the other, and therefore they have transmuted this thing into something that it shouldn't be. It should be about cancer. Not, you know, you have this kind of cancer and there's so much funding that would help you get better fast because there's the modes of modalities of treatment for breast cancer more so than there are for pancreatic cancer, more so than if you have cancer of the toe. This is what is happening with the story. They made it a kind of thing that is growing into a power base. And listen to me well. This is now growing into a power base for white women in America. And completely ignoring the idea that it should be about how these things happen. Nobody is talking about how come the criminal justice system isn't working or hasn't worked, despite the fact that most everybody, men and women, including the same women who are now prominent in this story, they didn't come forward. You see? So we have to be careful that we are aware that we're creating a monster here. And it's not Weinstein. He's been a monster for years. We're creating the monster of division. And this issue, a very legitimate issue, is now going to take all these various dimensions. You know, the stars are coming out and they making themselves known. Well, that may not be the best thing to do. Because most people suffering this problem can't get the same attention. And they will assume that they will. They just need to come forward and talk. No, it doesn't work that way. I covered, in fact, I was the one who wrote the story of Tawana Brawley. A young girl coming home from school is kidnapped by a bunch of men, among whom was a district attorney. An assistant district attorney, I should say. And to this day, the assumption was that she was going to get the same treatment as any other child or any other female under similar circumstances. And it all these years later, nobody believes what she said. To this day, there's no justice in that case, except that it was used to exonerate her attackers, who also included a part-time police officer. So we talk these things, and the news media, they concentrate on a case because primarily using the element of notoriety. So the case is well known because of its nature. But that's not the way it ought to be covered. This is a case about justice and injustice. How could a system within Hollywood cover up this case, although it is so pervasive? Why did the district attorney not bother with this case for so long? We're talking more than 20 years. Those are the questions. But instead, it is made to be a case in which glamorous women in a glamorous industry now have a better chance of getting justice than the general population, and men are going to be locked out of this. Children are going to be locked out of this. You would have to be a Hollywood star in order to get justice. That's what's going to happen now. They're not handling this thing well. They're handling it from a point of view of glamour, the glamorous set. And to be very honest, people think, well, what's the problem? This is what happens in Hollywood anyway. And now the idea is, oh no, we've decided that we are going to treat this in a very different manner. And we're seeing the power plays that are being made. Who is now going to speak for women who find themselves in the situation? When the fact is, you got to look and understand and study the nature of crimes, certain kinds of crimes. And you have to look to yourself, because a whole bunch of people who are out there may not be telling the truth. They just may not be telling the truth. It may just be a way of them reviving their flagging careers. There's a whole bunch of stuff here to consider. And nobody's really handling this in a responsible way. It's a big publicity stunt, it feels like. And in that situation, justice will be the victim. You won't get justice necessarily. because I could tell you right now, it would be he said, she said. You're not. It's the nature of this kind of crime that you won't have witnesses. So we would have created a major story in the minds of the public that cannot be prosecuted anyway. But the way it's being handled, it's become a stunt. And if they're serious about having this case mean something, these people better get some kind of advice about what they're doing. And they're doing things that would, in fact, erode people's chances of being believed or getting credible justice or even certain justice. There's a lot going on in this case that is disturbing. It's become a Hollywood stunt. Next thing you know, in order to report your crime, they're going to have a special place, and you have to have, you're properly dressed and you outfitted by the latest designer as you report your crime. This is crazy. It's a crazy thing that's going on here. And I see there are many women who are coming forward and pretty much telegraphing that it's a woman thing. It isn't a woman thing. It's not a Hollywood thing. It's a criminal situation that has to be handled with great care. Thank you so much for your call today. I really appreciate it. But this is the end of the program. How about that? I always am grateful to have such incredible callers. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. And have a great weekend.